Susan Glisson is the director of the William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation and Civic Renewal at the University of Mississippi, and is a native of Evans, Georgia. She was an assistant director at for the Center of the Study of Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi from 1998 to 2002. In 1998, she coordinated the only Deep South public forum for President Clinton's One America, an initiative on race, which led to the creation of the Institute for Racial Reconciliation. She is the author of First Freedoms, a documentary history of First Amendment rights in America, and she co-edited the recent volume, The Human Tradition in the Civil Rights Movement. Susan is a very dear friend of mine, and I'm thrilled to have you back as a very active part of the first three-year cycle of the project on Live Theology. Thank you for being here. Rydell Payne, many of you know, as the executive director of Abundant Life Ministry here in Charlottesville, and a real force for reconciliation, community building, and justice in Charlottesville for over a decade now. A dear friend of mine, a recipient of numerous civic awards locally and statewide. I'm thrilled that you'll be here as a sort of respondent conversation partner to Susan. So without further ado, thanks to both of you, and we look forward to this session on peace and the American organizing tradition.
I'm going to explode that cliche about saving the best for last, so I'm conscious of being in between you and lunch, so we'll dive right in. On October 2nd, a biracial group of citizens in Tallahatchie County, Mississippi, offered an apology to the family of Emmett Till for the miscarriage of justice in his murder in 1955. Till was the 14-year-old black child who had been savagely tortured and killed for allegedly whistling at a white woman. His death and the picture of his ravaged body on a Jet magazine cover mobilized thousands of African Americans to begin to directly challenge Jim Crow. Rosa Parks is said to have been thinking of Till when she was arrested on a Montgomery bus a few months after his death in 1955, and the young people who would 5 years later comprise the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee have been called the Emmett Till generation. Till's death is arguably the beginning of the modern civil rights movement. As well known and heavily analyzed as his death has been, in the community in which Till's murderers were acquitted, there had been little discussion or knowledge. Shortly after the murder, some white children played a game they called Strider Emmett Till. Strider was the sheriff who had testified on behalf of the defense in 1955. When their parents told him to stop playing the game, there were no explanations why, and while repercussions from the case swirled throughout the nation, silence descended in Tallahatchie. Jerome Little, the first black person elected to the Tallahatchie County Board of Supervisors, knew few of the facts of the case until he gained the political power to launch a public discussion of it. When Little became the first black chair of the Board of Supervisors, he persuaded his fellow supervisors, a majority white board, to create the Emmett Till Memorial Commission late in 2005. In 2006, Michelle Little invited the Winter Institute to support the work of the commission, asking us to help the area duplicate the success of the Philadelphia Coalition. The coalition is a multiracial group of citizens in Neshoba County, Mississippi, who in 2004 issued the first state-based public call for justice in the murders of three civil rights workers there in 1964. Their call and subsequent lobbying of their local district attorney and the state attorney general helped result in the only state conviction in the case. The Winter Institute has guided the Philadelphia Coalition since its inception. Little asked us to offer his community similar support. In our first conversation, Little said he wanted Tallahatchie to offer a statement similar to the Philadelphia statement. The power of Neshoba's statement was in the broad-based, multiracial leadership of the group and in the support their work received in the local community. In my first meetings with the Till Commission, I was the only white person. I knew we would have to broaden the base of the group. As we began to discuss white residents who might agree to join the commission, I was warned away from someone the black elected officials called the Godfather. Frank Michener, they noted, was the largest landowner in the area. In fact, Mr. Little had grown up on his plantation. The black members of the group said the most we could hope for in terms of Michener's support was for him to send a surrogate to the meetings. I reached out to Betty Pearson. Ms. Pearson is the only person still alive besides Roy Bryant's wife, Carolyn, who attended all 5 days of the Till trial. Long one of the few progressive whites in the area, Pearson went to the Till trial with her best friend, Florence Mars, who was later one of the few whites to challenge the Klan in Neshoba County. a courageous act that cost Mars her business. As a plantation owner herself, Pearson had been somewhat protected from the social costs of challenging white supremacy, though relations within her family were often strained. Pearson, who was 85 years old, was eager to join the commission as well as to try to persuade other white residents to participate. At an early meeting, she succeeded in persuading her neighbor, Frank Michener, to attend, along with his wife, Judith, and their daughter. It was with some shock that I realized the godfather was actually at a meeting. Michener, turns out, is incredibly charming, exceptionally well-read in matters of history, and a prominent member of Sumner's First Presbyterian Church. He liked that I'm a historian, and I spent a pleasant afternoon in his office looking through old documents and photographs of life in the Mississippi Delta. Michener's interest in the commission lay in its goal of restoring the Sumner Courthouse, where Bryant and Milam's trial had taken place. The courthouse is structurally unsound, and its likely demise seems to foreshadow the death of the small community. It's, you know, one of those traditional courthouse squares in the middle, and everything around it is pretty much dead. Both whites and blacks in the area want to save the courthouse, and hopefully the town. But they don't simply want to fix the courthouse. They hope to return it to its 1955 footprint, and include in its restoration the addition of a museum on the Till case in the Civil Rights Movement. They want to acknowledge their history. This goal has resulted in at least one charge of trying to make money off the blood of a martyr. Indeed, a local minister accused me of such in my first meeting with the commission. But as the commission continued to meet, there seemed to be widespread support among blacks and whites for preserving both the courthouse and its civil rights significance. As a tool for recruiting white members, the restoration project was quite effective. Once whites became part of the effort, there began to be fruitful conversations about the legacies of racism and the value of reconciliation. Nevertheless, when Jerome Little first proposed that the commission craft a statement like the Philadelphia Coalition, Mr. and Ms. Michener walked out of the meeting. In a later phone conversation, Michener explained to me that he did not condone the murder, and therefore he did not feel he owed anyone an apology for something he had not done. He asserted that he would never sign a statement. I explained this rationale to Mr. Little, who continued to insist that we find some way to make a public statement. As he described it, Mr. Little said he didn't care if the statement said mew, mew, mew. As long as it was something whites and blacks could agree on. He asked me to draft a statement for the group to consider. Believing that any statement I drafted would be drastically watered down, I began with the strongest rhetoric that I thought I could craft, calling for justice, for honest appraisals of the past, for telling the truth, and for understanding and dismantling the legacies of racism. Again, in a meeting where we presented the first draft, Mr. Michener walked out. Ms. Pearson gave Mr. Michener time to get home, and then she called him. She pleaded with him to at least permit me to come and discuss the need for a statement. He agreed. So a few weeks later, on a gorgeous sunny day, I drove the 72 miles from Oxford to Sumner, completely unsure of what I could say that might convince Mr. Michener to sign the statement. We began the two-hour conversation simply by visiting. I listened and learned his family history and his views on the complex and often hopeful relationships with blacks who worked on his family's farm. I learned of his deep disgust of the actions of Bryant and Milam and the local jury that had acquitted them. I also learned of his hopes for the future of his dying little town. Finally, near the end of the conversation, I explained that folks outside the state had not ever had the privilege I just had of learning from a prominent white person in the Mississippi Delta of his hopes and fears and regrets for the region. I explained in the absence of some public statement, the outside world would always believe that the jury that acquitted Milam and Bryant of the horrific crime actually spoke for the entire community. I suggested that as long as others believed such a horror had been condoned, it would be difficult to imagine any support or investment in the community's future. Most people outside the state believe the attitudes represented by Sumner deserve to die. I proposed that one of the only ways that Sumner would be seen with new eyes was for folks like Michener to tell the world what he just told me. I asked that he not let the 1955 jury verdict be the last word on the death of Emmett Till. There was quiet in the living room, and then Mr. Michener asked me to give him the draft statement that I'd written. He said to give him some time with it to see if he might edit it to something he could agree to sign. He offered me no promises. At the next commission meeting, he brought in the draft statement he had edited, and he offered a motion to the group to sign it and make it public. The motion was quickly seconded and passed unanimously. I was stunned by how quickly it had happened and paused to read the statement that Mr. Michener had offered. He had changed only two words from the original document. In March of this year, I had a vastly different experience around the notions of forgiveness and apology. I attended a conference of Mississippi Civil Rights Veterans in Jackson. One of the participants had been a mentor of mine, But we had not spoken since the release of the Philadelphia Coalition Statement for Justice in 2004. At that event, the coalition was joined by three congressmen, the current Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour, and 1,500 others as they issued their call for justice. Within 6 months of that event, the state of Mississippi had indicted Edgar Ray Killen on murder charges in the case. But the call for justice ceremony had been deeply controversial, partly because of the participation of the current governor, who was no supporter of civil rights efforts. One family member of the victim refused to attend and publicly questioned the motives of the local coalition in inviting the governor. A number of activists even accused the coalition of harboring Klansmen. Accusations surrounded the local group's work that spring of 2004. And then Haley Barbour sealed opposition by saying in his welcoming remarks that the murdered civil rights activists are comparable to the American soldiers fighting in the Iraq War. While I had been anxious about the group's invitation to the sitting governor, a well-known Republican opponent of racial progress, I nevertheless had learned from SNCC to support the decisions of local people. I also believed that Barbour's presence would recruit other conservative whites who might not otherwise join in the participations, who would not otherwise join in discussions on race. But many civil rights activists did not condone the coalition's decision, and their anger over Barbour's presence at the 2004 ceremony has been deep and abiding. My former mentor was one of those who was most angry. He held me singularly responsible for the decision to invite someone he despised to participate in the memorial to the three victims. I knew this person was angry with me. I did not understand the depths of his anger until I ran into him at the conference. He asked to speak to me. As the conference proceedings unfolded, he began to explain how he felt. He began by saying that he had created a training center out of the country to prepare activists and to promote healing, but he was puzzled by those who believe that healing comes through forgiveness. He said he just could not forgive. He related an encounter he said that he had with a psychiatrist who asked him in the middle of a session to go out into the street and slap the first white man he saw. He said he did this, and when he returned to the office, the physician asked how he felt. He said he felt better. He told me that there were some people he knew he should have just killed, and that the world would have been better off without them. He said that he knew he could not simply assault people or kill them, so instead he was trying to understand why people did the things they did. Then he made his request. He wanted me to begin to write him to explain my actions in Philadelphia. So it became clear. My former mentor preferred to hit me or kill me. Since he could not do that, he wanted me to justify myself. The work of the Winter Institute takes place between these two poles, of whites who do not believe that they should have to ask for forgiveness and of blacks who do not want to forgive. Somewhere in between is the need for truth-telling, justice, compassion, and patience, none of which are easy or simple. I must confess to you that I'm often confused as to the nature of our work or if it, in fact, isn't worthwhile at all. At times we have engaged in what might be described as civil rights work, seeking prosecutions for heinous crimes, helping to create infrastructure for affordable housing, helping a Delta town secure a sewer system. But most of our work has been in the realm of rhetoric, in effective discourse and public gestures of atonement, which ideally forge new relationships, thus allowing more substantive discourse and action to occur. And yet when 8,000 families still live in environmentally hazardous FEMA trailers on the Gulf Coast, when Mississippi communities place Spanish-speaking children into special ed classes simply because the children don't speak English, when the state of Mississippi refuses to revoke the license of an uncertified medical examiner whose testimony has most assuredly put innocent people in prison or on death row, it is difficult to consistently convince oneself that creating a safe place for honest dialogue on race is particularly helpful, or more to the point, too little too late. And so it was within the context of that perennial question that I have of our work at the Winter Institute that I received Charles's invitation to come back and speak about how current civil rights organizing might respond to Mrs. Adams' admonition to learn the language of peace. I was first reminded of the response of my advisory board when I proposed that we create a peace studies curriculum for the Winter Institute. They laughed and said it reminded them of hippies in Woodstock. Such, perhaps, is the fate of the concept of peace, reduced and commodified as it has become to T-shirts, bumper stickers, and keychains. But in a post-9/11 world, when the majority of armed conflicts around the globe employ child soldiers under the age of 16, it seems incumbent upon us to pull the concept out of our nostalgic files and reflect upon it with some seriousness. One of the major disagreements within the civil rights movement at its height was the tension between nonviolence as a strategy versus nonviolence as a way of life. Reverend James Lawson was the most noted proponent of nonviolence as a way of life, and his training of students in Nashville, Tennessee in 59 and 60 created some of the most stalwart young activists of the movement. It was indeed the students from Nashville who rescued the Freedom Rides in 1961 after violence in Anniston and Birmingham. As Diane Nash argued then, if violence stopped the rides, then the movement was over. Such contextualization of the power of passive resistance and nonviolent direct action, which includes negotiation as a first step before demonstrations, has long been left out of civil rights movement curriculum. Instead, as sociologist Charles Payne has argued, when young people today see footage of Bloody Sunday at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, they see weak activists being beaten by the Alabama Highway Patrol, rather than seeing the strength of accepting unearned blows in order to highlight the corruptness of the system and to offer witness to a better way. So as educators and activists, we've done a disservice to young people in not assuring that the concepts of nonviolence have been adequately incorporated into the anemic version of the civil rights movement that most students have. You know the one that says Rosa Parks sat down, Martin Luther King stood up, and everybody's free. We've left out the tedious, everyday, unglamorous, cooperative, non-hierarchical style of organizing and leadership that accomplished much of the sustainable successes of the movement. And we have failed to provide analytical tools to examine critically the ideas of freedom and peace and justice that animated the movement in rich and thoughtful ways. But beyond that educational disservice, I would argue that some in the movement, like my former mentor, have also lost the prophetic strength that the movement once had. The movement voice offered a trenchant commentary on the violent nature of our society and on the need for love, understanding, and forgiveness to break the cycles of violence that overwhelm us and dictate much of our domestic and foreign policies. Instead of showing us how to reach out to those who would be our enemies, many of the movement have moved on to other concerns or spent a good deal of time arguing over who owns their history. Truth be told, there were only very few at the height of the movement who displayed the ability to reach across those deep divisions. Those who did, like Will Campbell, who served the movement but who also ministered to the Klan, were most often vilified for suggesting that racists were human too. Perhaps Campbell's message was too difficult to be understood by people who were being beaten and killed by his Klan parishioners. But here we are now in a quandary. The fear our society has of black men is more pervasive than ever. The judge in the recent case against police officers who fired 50 shots into the SUV of Sean Bell justified the killings because he argued that it was reasonable to be afraid of black men, to believe that black men in a car must be gang members. If the civil rights movement is to regain a prophetic role, what must it say to the criminal justice system and to the culture at large about fear and loathing? Can it justify its isolation of white supremacists or conservatives while also attacking the wholesale bias against young black men that precedes disproportionate sentencing and overwhelming numbers tracked through the criminal justice system? In short, the isolation of individuals who are perceived as frightening prevents their redemption and restoration of humanity. If the civil rights community can't offer such possibility for racists, can expect to say something prophetic to the larger culture which demonizes blacks? This question points to a deeper tension within American culture. Much of our worldview as Americans has been shaped by the narrative of American exceptionalism. The story that we tell ourselves is that we are a city set upon a hill, destined to bring liberation and democracy to the world. The narrative is so compelling that we are too often unable to recognize the monstrousness within our own culture and within ourselves. When we are unable to read the landscape of our own national sins, of a founding in genocide and an economy grown on forced labor, then we too often view our actions and thus our domestic and foreign policies solely through the lens of that narrative. So the Iraq War can be sold as liberation. As Stanley Hauerwas has suggested, and I realize he's gotten criticism this week, we have failed to understand slavery, and so we are in Iraq. And this blindness also prevents our own self-examinations. What would such a consideration look like? The writer Wendell Berry argued in the months after 9/11, quote, what leads to peace is not violence, but peaceableness, which is not passivity, but an alert, informed, and practiced and active state of being. We should recognize that while we have extravagantly subsidized the means of war, we have almost totally neglected the ways of peaceableness. We have, for example, several national military academies, but not one peace academy. We have ignored the teachings and examples of Christ, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and other peaceable leaders. And here we have an inescapable duty to notice that war is profitable, whereas the means of peaceableness, being cheap or free, make no money. Berry goes on to say, quote, in a time such as this, when we have been seriously and most cruelly hurt by those who hate us, and when we must consider ourselves to be gravely threatened by those same people, it is hard to speak of the ways of peace and to remember that Christ enjoined us to love our enemies. But this is no less necessary for being difficult. Berry echoes an earlier prophet. In the 1950s, on the eve of the Civil Rights Revolution, Reverend Will D. Campbell was a chaplain at the University of Mississippi. After the 1954 Brown decision outlawing segregation in public schools, Campbell advocated passionately for integration and didn't long keep his job at Ole Miss for its troubles. As the nation faced the demands of a too long oppressed minority, prophetic voices like Campbell pushed the boundaries of prejudice. Significantly, Campbell did not only lobby for the equal treatment of African Americans, he also instructed a largely deaf generation of the travails of the white working class, warning that, quote, until recalcitrant white Southerners are made party to the truce, that there will be no settlement. The truce to which he referred was the one in which middle and upper income groups ended segregation because it was no longer good for business, not, he suggested, because they had been converted to some new belief in the beloved community. Campbell argued that this truce further economically and socially isolated poor whites, beyond how very little it actually changed the material circumstances of many blacks. Thus, Campbell suggested a bold measure in 1966. Quote, society has learned painfully to reject the murder, but not the murderer, he said. We dare to reject racism, but not the racist. As I watch Edgar Ray Killen, who would be convicted in the 1964 civil rights murders in Philadelphia, file into the Neshoba County Courthouse in January 2005, Campbell's words haunted me. Those responsible for the murders of the three young men in Philadelphia in 64 should be held accountable. In 1964, But Killen's trial begs the question of the climate in which the murders occurred. In 1964, the KKK were members of the local and state police and received information from the state-sponsored Sovereignty Commission, which spied on civil rights activists and provided information to the Klan and the White Citizens' Councils to harass or injure them. In 1964, the state of Mississippi and many of its white citizens condoned or participated in such behavior. And what happened to those voices that preached moderation or more boldly called for equality? Campbell was run out of the state, as were the Hefners and McComb. Civil rights leaders like Medgar Evers were assassinated. We have come far in the South, but there is still pain associated with acknowledging those dark days. Partly that pain exists because many of these issues remained unresolved and operational in current policies and daily interactions. So we must frankly confront that past for those wounds to heal, so we can begin to understand the legacy of racism that continues to harm us today in education, healthcare, housing, and other facets of life. For much of our history, churches were in cultural captivity, as John Leamy called them, not the conscience of the state as King admonished they should be, but subservient to its needs. What do our churches today tell us about race? Who will confess the wrongs that have been done? Who are our philosophers telling us today the uncomfortable truths? Might they be in Philadelphia or Macomb or Greenwood? And will they remind us that all of us must sit in the table of brotherhood, not just those with wealth or education or status? In Plato's Allegory of the Cave, the philosopher asserts that, quote, in the world of knowledge, the idea of good appears last of all and is seen only with an effort. This confrontation with the past, this necessary search for truth, will not be easy, but it is the only way our state, our region, and our nation can fulfill its promise of democracy. And it cannot be simply limited to truth-telling. I believe there must also be forgiveness, the giving up of resentment, and reconciliation, the building of a beloved community, or we will continue these cycles. Can the philosophy of nonviolence offer an antidote? I'm worried that the permeation of violence in our culture is too often not mitigated by the language of nonviolence, which itself often borrows militaristic rhetoric to describe its cause. One of my favorite prayers is from Reverend James Lawson, who appealed to God in Reverend Kelly Miller Smith's Nashville church a few years ago. Quote, when the battle seems lost, when cowards shirk the field and heroes fall around the standard, may my feet be found where the fighting is fiercest. It's a powerful prayer, but it borrows from the language of war to make its appeal. My Southern Baptist Church did the same thing this past Easter Sunday. I watched in awe of a special Easter PowerPoint, not the least of which because there was a PowerPoint, with a little bouncing ball, which spoke of the soldiers of God and the mighty battles in which they were engaged. What are the consequences of characterizing those with whom we disagree as enemies in a battle? What are the ramifications of using militaristic language to describe an effort to secure peace? In what ways does such language proscribe our ability to envision the transformation of enemies into friends? Audre Lorde admonished that the master's tools cannot dismantle the master's house. How then must the language of peace speak to us? Gandhi has something to offer to this discussion. His creation of the term Satyagraha, or truth force, pointed to a different way. Gandhi commanded conversion, not coercion, and was careful to instruct that those engaged in the work of Satyagraha must be trained not to become intolerant of those who oppose them. William Gay goes a bit further, distinguishing the language of violence from the language of negative peace and the language of positive peace. The language of peace, positive peace, he proposes, is democratic rather than authoritarian, dialogical rather than monological, receptive rather than aggressive, meditative rather than calculative. The language of positive peace is not passive in the sense of avoiding engagement. It is pacific in the sense of seeking to actively build lasting peace and justice. The language of positive peace, he continues, is a genuinely pacific discourse and provides a way of perceiving and communicating that frees us to the diversity and open-endedness of life rather than the sameness and finality of death. The language of positive peace can provide the communicative means to overcome linguistic violence and linguistic alienation. Pacific discourse and providing alternative to the language of war and even to the language of negative peace is the voice of hope and empowerment. Language is living, however, and evolves and devolves and can evolve again. In the first meeting of the Philadelphia Coalition, a black person proposed having a march to commemorate the murdered civil rights workers. The white folks in the room got paler, but no one countered the suggestion. A moment later, a white person proposed having a resolution, and all the black folks in the room rolled their eyes. But no one refuted the suggestion. After the meeting, the black co-chair asked his white counterpart why a march was controversial. The white co-chair explained that whites think of Birmingham and Selma when they think of marches. They presume they end in rioting and bloodshed. He then queried why a resolution seemed problematic. The black co-chair explained that for blacks, resolution is just words on a page, more promises that will likely remain unfulfilled. Communication is difficult if we don't even speak the same language, much less have to grapple with something as deep and powerful as the concept of peace. Vaclav Havel noted the problem with the concept in his own country. He recounted how the word had been debased under the Soviets and reclaimed during the Velvet Revolution. Quote, in spite of the lengthy process of systematically divesting the word peace of all meaning, worse than that, investing instead with quite the opposite meaning to that given in a dictionary, a number of Don Quixotes and several of their younger colleagues in the Independent Peace Association have managed to rehabilitate the word and restore its original meaning. Naturally, though, they have had to pay a price for their semantic perestroika, that is, standing the word peace back on its feet again. Almost all the youngsters who led the Independent Peace Association were obliged to spend a few months in jail for their pains. It was worth it, though. One important word has been rescued from total debasement. And it is not just a question of saving a word, as I have been trying to explain. Something far more important was saved. Havel went on to say that, quote, it is not hard to demonstrate that all the main threats confronting the world today, from atomic war and ecological disaster to a catastrophic collapse of society and civilization, by which I mean the widening gulf between rich and poor individuals and nations, have hidden deeply within them a single root cause, the imperceptible transformation of what was originally a humble message into an arrogant one. The task of constant rhetorical vigilance, of passing along critical tools of analysis to young people, over and above sharing strategies for dismantling power and ensuring equality, can be daunting. We must cope with the cacophony of a 24-hour news cycle, often divested of analysis and too often consumed by distractions. In March, a reporter queried me about race and politics, specifically about the uproar over selected comments and guilt by association of Barack Obama to Jeremiah Wright. I responded that productive, healing dialogue on race could not, on some level, be held nationally. That to be effective, it must be local. I also suggested that there was a more important question to be asked than who would win the upcoming presidential election. It would take bold vision to ask what kind of country we want to have. Pretty quickly after that interview, I realized that my question had been too small. The deeper and more significant question is what kind of humanity we want to be. In Mississippi, since the Killen trial in 2005, a number of us have been attempting to answer that question by laying the groundwork for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the state. While our efforts were delayed a bit by Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath, the storm served only to highlight the tremendous need to understand systems of oppression in order to dismantle them. Since January, we've held a series of exploratory meetings around the state to gauge interest in creating a commission. From all walks of life, from activists and business people, from religious leaders to young people, there is an emerging consensus that Mississippi needs to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And yet, in a recent statewide meeting to determine next steps, a white minister averred that she would have a hard time being in the same room that allowed Klansmen to testify about their behavior. How will we be able to find a way forward together if we cannot even be in the same room with each other? In The Art of War, written in China over 2,000 years ago and perhaps the oldest text on war, Sun Tzu said, all warfare is based on deception. Concomitantly, I would posit the opposite. All peace is based in truth. So, Charles, I don't have anything really to offer but questions. Mrs. Adams was onto something, but we have a long road ahead of us to hearken to her message. I can attest that this is what reconciliation looks like on the ground. It's not easy. In fact, it's horribly messy and complicated. Every person who engages in community reconciliation, which is another word, I think, for peace, brings their own agenda, history, and needs. Reconciliation is a constant negotiation between those needs, trying to prioritize them in ways that accomplish the most common good. And it is not always clear what the most good is. At the very least, it seems to me, it involves a few components. First, reconciliation is engendered through the empowerment of local communities for purposeful change. This positive change comes in the creation of truthful dialogue that encourages action to redress historical inequity. Reconciliation at the local level can be highly contested. Each community must decide together how to bury the past in a just and constructive way. The debate is often stymied around the extent to which collective forgetting is essential to the task of moving forward. What seems applicable in a national or international theoretical framework may not always fit neatly into local understandings of reconciliation. Thus, it is imperative for each community to define for itself what reconciliation and peace will look like. Second, theologian Donald Shriver notes that, quote, forgetfulness is the enemy of justice. Unless one takes refuge in that untrue truism, there is nothing we can do to change the past. On the contrary, Shriver challenges us to change our relation to the past. The first step for doing so is uncovering its dreaded secrets. There can be no final burial of the past before an inquest. He urges communities not to forgive and forget, but to remember and forgive, noting that a tangible way of doing so is to have one's unjust suffering entered into a public record as an increment of justice. Others encourage communities to be experimental in their approach. Historian Charles Meyer posits that, quote, reconciliation is not a monument, but a process, not a museum, but a growing inventory of an active memory, not a theory, but an experimental practice, unquote. Thus, the dialogue among community members must be persistent and mindful always of including others in the quest for truth and consensus. And lastly, justice is a prerequisite to reconciliation. Scholar and activist Michael Ignatieff has suggested that, quote, justice entails the naming of specific individuals and not the wholesale blame of history. Questioning whether a nation can ever be fully reconciled, he suggests that the aim of justice and truth-seeking be to narrow the range of permissible lies in an argument that is the past. Because truth is dependent upon identity and therefore is interpretive, he insists that justice must be separate from reconciliation and that truth does not always heal. Reconciliation must respect the emotions that sustain vengeance, Ignatieff writes, which means honoring the dead together. He suggests the enactment of public rituals of atonement between individuals, thus breaking the spiral of intergenerational vengeance. It is this public atonement that most aptly characterizes restorative justice, the repairing of that which is damaged between individuals and amidst communities. In understanding this process of reconciliation, ultimately rooted in interpersonal dialogue that moves beyond rhetoric to action, there is hope for change. We must move beyond the culturally encoded language of remembrance and guilt and strive to supplant mere coexistence with the reality of reconciliation. We can overcome distrust and animosity by restoring not only the dignity of the victim, but that of the perpetrator as well. The end result must maintain a vision that sees a way out of the cyclical nature of racism. Charles Marsh has suggested that the new activists working in rural and urban areas remind us of the sobering fact that the difficult work of achieving equality awaits more difficult work. Indeed, the daily disciplines and sacrifices required to sustain the beloved community. It is important to close with this last assessment. I do not doubt the sincerity of every person I have encountered in my work in Mississippi and each one's interest in making it a better place. I've listened enough to know that the goals of those whom we serve are remarkably similar. The differences exist in the steps and the strategies it will take to accomplish those goals. And the entire state must learn together how to trust and how to shape relationships and policies that will accomplish these goals. Whites must come to understand the privilege they continue to enjoy and the dangerous but almost automatic assumption that things must be done their way. Victims of oppression, conversely, must recognize honest, if uneven, attempts to reach out to address their concerns. The process must be truthful, transparent, and inclusive. It should also be cathartic for those who are wounded and retributive where it can be. But a community working diligently to come together cannot forever be held hostage to the rage that those who have suffered understandably feel. Only the local community can decide how and when to move forward together. In the end, the entire process will be imperfect, painful, and unpredictable. Albert Camus wrote in Neither Victims Nor Executioners at the end of World War II that, quote, henceforth, the only honorable course will be to stake everything on a formidable gamble, that words are more powerful than munitions. I cannot help but think of the Amish community in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania, who lost 5 girls aged 6 to 13 to a gunman who held the girls hostage in their schoolroom before killing them execution style and then taking his own life. On the day of the shooting, a grandfather of one of the victims offered forgiveness to the shooter, and 75 members of the community attended his funeral and reached out to his widow and children. I'm fairly confident that I do not possess the deep wells of faith and understanding of grace necessary to duplicate the Amish example. But I can tell you that I'm convinced that they have something important to teach us about building a bridge of hope across deeply traumatic experiences and histories. In Mississippi, despite its great difficulties and pain, in spite of different perceptions of the meaning and the strategies of the work, people are working together toward a better tomorrow. We are learning, I hope, what Rhonda referred to yesterday, the letter Thomas Merton offered to a young activist in 1966. Do not depend on the hope of results. When you are doing the sort of work you have taken on, essentially an apostolic work, you may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and achieve no result at all, if not perhaps results opposite to what you expect. As you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the righteousness, the truth of the work itself. And there, too, a great deal has to be gone through as you gradually struggle less and less for an idea and more for specific people. The range tends to narrow down, but it gets much more real. In the end, it is the reality of personal relationships that save everything. Thank you.
I was just making sure she got the applause that she deserved. I have always been refreshed by these weeks, though oftentimes find it hard to see everything. But the things I get to see and hear has always been very, very, very encouraging to me. And so it's been a gift to me, certainly, to hear Eugene deconstruct capitalism in such a way that I go, yeah, I wish I could memorize that one, get that down. I'm also quite jealous of Victoria, who gets to look at the Bonhoeffer documents all day and be influenced by that. And she's probably going, no, you don't want to do that. But I'm jealous of that and wish I had the skills to do that. I also recognize that there are Davids and there are Solomons, in that David had a great desire to build a temple for God, but Solomon built it. And there are different roles that we play, and there are different ways we go about expressing what's on our hearts, what we think about, what we study. And I appreciate Charles giving me the liberty to talk about beautiful songs. Songs are very important. Valerie ended up with this picture of the eschaton, if you will. I think that's the right word. And we certainly debate about a lot of things in terms of the end times, but when John looks into heaven, there are a couple of things that are very clear. First is diversity. And John is speaking to what he's seeing, and he's seeing a group of people worshiping God. So that's the second thing that's clear. And the third thing I'd say is that they're actually not looking at one another, that their focus is on God. So somehow we have to learn how to take the focus off of one another and put it on God. So, that's not to say I'm about ready to preach a sermon to you, though I may have a preaching style. as I talk to you, and I am, this is the Bible, and I'm opening up, and I'm gonna get to that. But before I get to it, 7 minutes, can you tell me when 7 minutes is up? Because I want to be done in 7 minutes, because I have a 1 o'clock meeting that I need to be at that's very important. And I apologize for that, too, that I don't get to celebrate with you in song and in the Eucharist what I think is certainly most important. So I do apologize for that, but perhaps in these next 10 minutes we'll get to enjoy what you are preparing for in a few moments. Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. I'm saying, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as the moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly. Still in peaceful dreams, I see the road leads back to you. I said, oh, Georgia, no peace, no peace I find. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. So what keeps reconciliation on your mind? What keeps the picture of heaven on your mind? If that's where we're going to be, and we're here now, what keeps that picture in our mind so that it informs what we do now to get to there? The state of Virginia issued an apology for slavery just over a year ago, February 2007. And many of you perhaps may have known that, but many of you may not have known that. How many people knew that, by the way? Awesome. That means I was just somewhere else. But as you look at it, why was it done? Why was it done? And it begs the question of how important capitalism is for us. Because it really was done, in my own personal opinion, and I could be wrong, that we were celebrating a few months later the establishment of the first colony in Virginia or in our history. So it was done with a purpose or a strategy, if you will. And as Susan talked, there is dichotomy in us all over the place. And it's a dichotomy that is the barrier. There is this sin among us, and as was spoken earlier, we need not to stay there. But from here to here, we have to deal with not being quite perfect yet. And I think the picture of the beloved community is a thing that we can work towards. We can do it intentionally. It can just so happen. But I think it brings great pleasure to God's heart to be very intentional about being around the other. I think that is a model that Jesus demonstrated and one that we are to follow as well. So, in Ephesians, a prayer that Paul has, chapter 3, verses 14 through 21. And I'm not going to read very much of it. I'm just going to say Paul is lavished with the love of Christ, its depth, its width, its breadth, and his desire for that for the church at Ephesus is profound. And it's certainly the gospel that I seek to emulate and encourage. However, there is this place of where we have to go, and yet We do have to recognize where we're at. So, as I have intentionally built or been a part of an intentional community, as I have been a part of a church that has sought to be a diverse church, as I have sought to develop relationships with the other, I've had to realize or grapple with the race relations that I have been taught from a very early age. And I'm not going to get detailed to that other than to say that I was taught that you don't trust whites but so far. Okay, so I was born in 1965, so from 65 to 75, 80-ish or so, as I live with my family, that's basically what I was taught. So, I resisted that. Me and my cousin and others, we resisted that and said, that's not the way in which we're going to go. And went throughout college, and as I said, intentional community, a part of a church that was growing in its diversity, and developing relationships with someone who was white, felt quite free to do that, quite loved them as a brother in Christ as I would love anyone else. However, when a little betrayal came, not a little, but I felt a lot of betrayal in a professional situation, and also in a personal situation, two things kind of colliding at once, and they both happened to be white, race relations 101 came out real quickly. And I found myself saying, no, the white woman did that. So I say that as a confession, recognizing that those thoughts have to continually be taken captive as I seek to develop genuine relationships for the kingdom. So how do we do it? I don't really know how we do it, because I'm young, as someone said earlier. But I am clear that the language of love and the language of peace is the road in which to take that will get me to there. So, if the music was playing, you was going to get to hear Georgia on My Mind by Van Morrison, though Van didn't sing it. Who sung it? Did he write it? You don't need to know this, but he didn't. It was wrote back in the 30s, and he's kind of reflecting on the song that he used to hear. It's written by Stuart Gorrell. And one of my favorite folks is musicians is Van Morrison, and I find that I can get more done in listening to music and in worshiping than perhaps I can get done at trying to articulate why I struggle with race relations 101. So, in closing, I'd like to quote a few folks. One is a waitress at the Italian Villa that I frequent. That's where I'm heading to at 1 o'clock and meeting someone. But the waitress says, "We've come a long way, but we have a long way to go." Amen. And I've recognized that the only thing I have to offer is forgiveness. If I offer anything less, it distorts and breaks down beloved community very quickly. So, in Van Morrison fashion, I'll close and say, she is as sweet as Tipaloo honey. Just like the honey from a bee. She's an angel of the first degree. It's important that this next stanza that you hear, which keeps me focused on that picture, and it is, you can't stop us on the road to freedom. You can't keep us because our eyes can see. Men in granite, men intending on chivalry. Intent on chivalry. Intent on love. Struggling to embrace love. Accessing all the theological understanding and all of our devotion to love, to forgive, and to grow towards that eschaton. Thank you.